thanks for joining How Did We Get Here, where we flip ideas on how we move through this life and talk about what's really going on here. Welcome back to How Did We Get Here? Thank you for joining us again, where we talk about where we're coming from and what's really going on here. Today we talk about becoming American with renowned scholar, historian, and author, master storyteller, Tamim Ansari. His recent book, Road Trips, Becoming an American in the Vapor Trail of the 60s, is out now. He has a work coming out next year called The Invention of Yesterday, speaking of all things history and becoming a being on this planet. And you may be familiar with Destiny Disrupted or West of Kabul, East of New York, one of the most important books of the past 20 years written after 9/11 and a very important story. So find those on Tamim's website. You can also go on our page to learn more. This is a conversation where we get into the interpersonal. We get into the road trip story. We go back from the 60s to the 70s to now and the turn of the century. And I think that you'll enjoy it. Feel free to share your stories as well. Follow along with Tamim Ansari on his website. And here is our conversation.
The thing that maybe you all don't know is you had this wonderful cat, Raul, that I was lucky to spend time with.
Yes, you know about that.
What I want to actually start off before we get into talking about road trips, particularly in the metaphor of road trips and becoming American and those experiences, is I wanted to actually ask you if you would take a moment to explain spoothiness, because you sent me this beautiful note a few years ago when I was having, you know, just having this unique time. I moved around my whole life. I'm bicultural. I'm used to swimming in and out and having to deal with that kind of life. And it just seemed sort of the mountain of things that kept happening. And you introduced me to this beautiful term called spoothiness.
Spoothiness? It was.
It's almost sort of this fog on the street corner. Like you can't quite see it yet. So you know a town, but you've just introduced yourself to town. You're just there. And then in time, it'll become something that becomes more known to you. And you said it in much more beautiful language, and I'm remembering it. But in what that experience is of coming back and realizing that in time, and between now and then, there's this sort of spoothiness before you know each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I can say about towns is what I thought about San Francisco after I'd lived in Portland for many years. Mm-hmm. And I came to San Francisco. It's a beautiful town. Everywhere I look, it's something great. But it was like being in an art museum. And the thing was, no place was a place in which something dramatic had happened to me. So, and then after you live in a place for a while, more and more the surface disappears, and you kind of look through that and you resonate to the emotions you have that were created by the life you've lived in that place.
Yeah, that was the spoothiness that you shared, that it becomes, that it's this, not sort of this empty vessel, but I think art museum is a good way to put it, but it's this very distant thing from yourself, and then suddenly it's very alive.
Yeah.
You've talked before about, in the historical sense, of following the arc of the narrative, following essentially where that goes and where that takes you back and where we meet and make sense of patterns. And if you were to follow your arc of your narrative, you've had quite an interesting life. Amos Oz has this quote about being a witness and a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I feel that there's something unique for those of us, particularly who are living between two identities or two worlds or two cultures, right away prescripted to be into that witness and storyteller. And you're one of the most phenomenal storytellers I know. And so you're welcome. I'm very grateful for all the work that you've done and that you've shared, and the way that folks don't even know off the page how much to me means in the community. For you, though, you recently came to this work that you created, Road Trips, Becoming an American in the Vapor Trail of the 60s. You have one of the early lines is, "The summer that men set a foot on the moon, I decided to see if I could hike across North America on $5 and the kindness of strangers," which is ironically actually a message that you might not be too surprised hit some people that head out to the islands as well. But for you, looking back on that arc of that narrative and remembering that kid that thought $5 would get them through.
Yeah. Well, you know, the arc of the narrative is an interesting thing with road trips, because I actually wrote one book that turned into two books. You know, I was writing just every day without any particular thought about what was this thing I was creating. It had started out as the idea that, oh, a trip to someplace far away that's difficult to reach, and if you do it, it has a narrative arc built in. It's an odyssey. And I'm going to take three trips that were iconic in my life, and I'll just take one session to write each one entirely. And then those will be little gems, you know, they'll be
right.
They'll be honest. But it turned out that it wasn't that easy. You know, it's like telling about the $5 trip. It just, I kept writing and writing. It was fun to write about. It took me a long time to even get to the place where I left town. And then I thought, all three of my trips that I chose happened after I came to America. Mm. And how is it that it didn't even occur to me to include that journey from Afghanistan to America as one of my iconic trips? So then I said, I'm going to do that. But when I sat down to put down everything I remembered about that journey, what I realized is I don't remember anything about it. You know, I was in Afghanistan, and then later I was in America. And, you know, I have the historic information about how I came here. You know I went to this city and that city. I just didn't have any images of it. You know, so then I said, what do I remember about before I came here? And I just got into just writing anything that came to mind each day at a certain time. I just sit down. And I generated 1,000 pages altogether of these four road trips. You know, when 9/11 happened, I had an agent, and the agent said, you got to give me a piece of nonfiction. Don't bother me with fiction anymore.
Yeah. Well, folks don't realize by the time, so we're jumping to, like, so by 2001, but when 9/11 hits, between the time of Road Trips, the latest book, in the sort of the late 60s and 2000, you'd been working on children's book, you'd been working on other projects at that point. You weren't working on starting to create sort of these memoirish experiences.
That's right. I actually was working on what I now conceive of as my memoir sort of project and idea, but I wasn't aware of it. I was writing other stuff. You know, for the most part, I was slaving away at a novel, which I'm still working on.
Aren't we all? That's redeeming to know. It's always helpful for those of us, I think, to hear out there, because you're in the same loop, right? You don't feel time that way.
You don't feel time the same way. I do smile when some of the people I work with say, you know, I've been working on this novel for a year. Really, a year. I'm so impressed.
Yeah, you've barely scraped the dirt off the ground.
That's right. But in any case, you know, I looked at these 1,000 pages and I said, well, there's a book here about being bicultural. So I took that part out. You know, and I used one of those trips in west of Kabul, east of New York. It was the trip where I went to the Islamic world and I came back. Yeah. I was in love. I married Debbie. My life bloomed. Everything was great. That was a great happy ending. Then I had these two other trips. I didn't want to throw them away. And for some reason, I felt like I have to have three. I don't know why, but, you know, that was in there. And I wrote and wrote and wrote this stuff. I couldn't get a handle on it until I figured out what it was about. And it was about becoming an American. You know, I didn't realize that. It hadn't crossed my mind that when I came here, I was some weird other thing. But, you know, I wasn't strictly speaking an Afghan. You know about this experience. I was bicultural, and so it was a confusing world for me in that way. When I was in Afghanistan, too, I was not... You know, alienated was my most defining feature.
Right, exactly. There's a thing for those of us who live in the board. Yeah. You know, we're not that, you know, and we're not that. You're constantly having to make meaning and mostly spending a lot of time translation and certainly mostly spending a lot of time pretty isolated. I think that's why I appreciated your work. I appreciated Obama's Dreams of My Father works that started to... It just makes sense. It's why Meghan Markle makes sense. Right? It's why Obama makes sense. As human beings, it's not a political statement. It's as simple like this is what that's what life feels like.
Well, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so my father was enlisted in the Marine Corps. So the shortest version of that is in the 13 colonies. We moved up and down the East Coast primarily. My father was enlisted, so certainly got sent overseas. And my mother is Honduran, though, so she came here in her 20s, late 20s, and then they, you know, met on a blind date. My mom's an extremely gorgeous woman. My father was very happy. He had a letter written in Spanish sent to my grandmother, and that's the last Spanish I think she got him to speak. My mother was an only child. Her father, she's Honduran, and so she's from the capital, Tegucigalpa, or Comayagua, the sort of the neighborhood, a barrio that's there. And she grew up there, but my grandmother had been an orphan.
Yeah.
And had worked really hard. And so I'm sure everybody has these versions of stories. And she'd worked really hard when she had her daughter to put her in schools to learn English so she could one day maybe come to the States. At the same time, my mother's father was shot when my mother was 7 years old. And so my mother had a variety of tragedies. My grandmother did everything she could to get her to learn English and get her to get a chance to come to the States and stay with a family that had a woman named Nancy. And that's where I'm named after. And my father was based nearby there, and my father was from a family, not an only child. He grew up sharecropper's kids, really poor factory sharecropper's kids, one of nine. He just wanted to go hunting and fishing and be left alone. And so these two, speaking of cultural, you know, he's from the country. He's from the deep south, you know, and light skin. And obviously I'm light skin. My brother's dark skin. My mother's darker skinned. And it was just a complete clash of every kind of culture, geographic, racial, and certainly linguistic and everything else. But they're still together. And so that's, where, I guess, a version of where I come from. But I grew up and down the East Coast and have lived and traveled through most of the states and then lived in the West Coast most of the last 10 years before coming to the islands. Yeah, so that's unfortunately the shortest answer I can give.
Okay, well, you got a lot of scramble in your background too.
Yeah.
Nowadays, identity has become a, it's being brought into focus as something that has political import. And for a person like me, and maybe you experience this too, I'm not comfortable with, for example, being asked to come and speak as the Afghan author.
The representative,
ghettoization that I don't want to get in.
It's not complete.
I just want to be a person of the world, and therefore I feel, you know, some commitment to trying to create culturally frameworks that are not this little identity and that little identity, some kind of world identity. We got to build it.
Right. It's interesting to talk about road trips as an iconic sort of American. I'll talk to Hawaiian Cowboy as well later down the way. And so you take this sort of very affiliated, and I would say that's largely cinema, right? But, you know, cinema comes from an idea that we've had historically as well. You know, this affiliated concept of road trip being a very American, you know, post-50s concept. And you're coming from having a perspective that does allow that witnessing, which is its own way to have to carry and keep explaining of that witnessing of sort of where the globe meets. Because my mother is Honduran, and my father deep south during desegregation, and my mother from Honduras, from the Americas, and what that tells of the story of the Americas as well as, again, foreign policy as well. And so we're coming in this intersection when, we just want to be us, but there's not really a place for us that doesn't involve that. Yeah, it becomes a tiresome thing. I think what's on my end, because I don't look, obviously, I have folks who are both Latino and certainly very many folks who are white or gringos, as we say in Spanish, or Caucasian Americans, that asterisk there. So think that they can communicate certain things and don't recognize who I am, right? And so that passing certainly is a difficulty. But it's so I get burdened in a different way that I think certainly some people of other identities get burdened. And I think road trips is a fantastic way at both telling the history that people may need to hear and translating it in a way that it's a voice that we can recognize. But at the same time, when you get to be you, I think in this last book, you get to be you a little bit more. You get to show who you are without having to represent.
Once you look closely, nobody is socialized. No. The kind of thing that I experienced in terms of alienation, everybody's got that at some level or in some way in their life, you know. When I was in Afghanistan growing up, and then when I came to the States, for me, there was this great idea of what the United States was about. It still feels noble to me. And that was that everybody could be themselves and still be part of some greater thing.
Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about.
My father, who was from here,
yeah.
You know, he grew up certainly in the Vietnam era and, you know, went through poverty and, you know, in order to have something to get out, you know, went into the military. So he was much more cynical, and he was the Marine. He was much more cynical about my country. But it was my mother who taught me to write to the government and how great America is. And look, the president writes you a letter back. And even when things are really difficult, of just that very much that hope.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, if you think we're losing it, then so in 69, so you took off to take that trek. At that time, did you feel hope in kind of the country and what you would see, or you were really trying to learn more about yourself as well, and that becoming American kind of question for yourself, becoming who you are?
I think back to it, and I realize that one of the things that didn't enter into my mind was, you know, what if I end up someplace in a ditch?
Yeah.
Dad,
right.
You know, I had a story like feeling about my life. So I assumed that there would be difficulties. And then in the end, that's how stories are. You know,
there's going to be that part, but you're going to get to the other part, right? Why is it that some of us seem to know that early? I don't know what that is, but some of us seem to like that's going to come, but there's going to also be this other turn. Suppose there's so many books, there's so much film. Is it just something in your heart? Is it something from your family experience? What is that about knowing that it's an art, understanding that that's the journey?
I think for me, probably part of it is that I was so steeped in stories growing up. And on both sides of the aisle, culturally, you know, it's like I read voraciously and I read stories because, you know, partly because I was this alienated guy that, you know, Afghan culture was all around me and I was Afghan, but I also longed for connection to this other thing. And, you know, at my... you know, my mother sort of built a little America inside of our home, this like little nest that we had. And so that so that all of my outer self was Afghan, but the inner core was this American guy. So without Americans around, my contact with that was stories, was things I could read. And then, you know, Afghan culture is a storytelling culture. It's not, they don't have books of stories. The books are highfalutin poetry and stuff that is impossible to read when you're a kid. But you hang around with people and they're telling stories relentlessly. And I had a lot of great storytellers in my family. So I grew up with stories. And I think that sort of vested me with a sense of life itself as a story. Yeah. And nowadays, I think, the whole memoir project or that orientation has to do with, what I'm thinking about is that the story is real and it's none of the material facts. You know, it's like a trillion things have happened to each of us and we're selecting some of those and we're drawing a line through it and saying, this is my life story. You know, what I write nowadays is memoir and history. And that's the other thing I write. And I feel like those are the same thing, actually. You know, history, too. Millions of things have happened. Yes, history has to have true facts in it. You can't just make this stuff up. But the actual thing is not the fact. It's that line that you're making visible by how you're arranging the facts. And that's a story. And that's something that's essential to us as human beings.
I think you're an extremely powerful storyteller, so I highly recommend Tamim's book, West of Kabul, East of New York, Destiny Disrupted, which is a history of the world through Islamic eyes. That is an incredible work of history. The book, Games Without Rules and Interrupted History, that is that title alone should get you all. But Road Trips, when you sit here and you talk about becoming American, what does that mean? You hit the road. Who were you before and who were you on the other side of that?
Well, I would say, you know, this is my personal experience of the journey that I went through then, which is that before, you know, at the outset, I felt like I was a guy who, when I walked into a room, everyone got polite because the foreigner was here.
Oh,
and I felt a little awkward, and I didn't want to disrupt the social comfort that was there before I arrived, but just because I was there,
yeah.
It wasn't as comfortable as it was before. And so when I came out the other side, it was like, I don't know, you know, I didn't care. I was fine. I could walk in anywhere. It didn't matter who was there. I was me, and you guys could be you, and that was fine. And I didn't feel like I made people uncomfortable being who I was.
You had to repeat that over and over again, almost the way that a stand-up comic gets better by, you know, redoing their act. Do you know what I mean? Or you get better as a writer. Obviously, you go back and back at it. Do you think you got better at that sense of being, whatever you may be, you know, in the room, by essentially going out and confronting that over and over again?
Actually, I would say, however, that there's another aspect to road trips that I was also aware of as I was writing it, which is that it's a coming of age story. It's like I was a kid, and then I ended up as vaguely something like an adult.
We're all still getting there.
So that was happening, and everybody's got that coming of age story, and things change, and you're someone different at the end of it. But that happened to happen right when the 60s were turning into the 70s, and something changed in the history of our country and in the culture in that same period. So it was not that easy to distinguish whether it was me changing or the world changing. And I wanted to try to get at that other change that was going on at the same time. The book I've just finished writing, which is coming out this fall, and the title of it is The Invention of Yesterday.
I love that.
It's another take on the history of the world, you know. But what I'm interested in is that the clear trajectory of human history is we're more and more interconnected. Anything else you can interpret, but that one thing is not going to change. We're not going to be less interconnected 100 years from now. But somehow, no matter how interconnected we get, we're still fighting just like we were. How is it?
Well, it is. Liz Gilbert, the writer, had this metaphor. He talked about porcupines. They have to get close to get warm, you know? But then, of course, when they get too close, they poke each other. So they have to get just close enough to stay warm and not poke each other.
Sorry, porcupines now.
Oh, yeah. You got to feel bad for them. And it's, you know, it's any, even people that care about each other deeply, you put them in enough space for enough hours in a row. But the issue going on right now is these are not, we're talking at folks that are nowhere near us, right? That are sometimes, whether we can agree on it, all of us or not, some things that aren't quite happening that way, that the facts don't back up.
Yeah.
And so we're in this fear kind of loop, but we're in a pretty serious one. I think that talking about the invention of yesterday is a great way to put it. There's something in pausing and stepping back into story and recognizing where history can give you pause, can give you humanity, but can also show you where you need to stand with, where you may need to consider standing with conviction.
Well, you know, what strikes me is that we all live in imaginary worlds.
Yeah.
You know, we imagine these worlds into being together by the stories we tell, by the, you know, our patterns of intercommunication. But we have a need to live in a world that's coherent, that everything makes sense with everything else. And there are periods when there's a big loose world and everything kind of makes sense, you know, and there's room there for this and there's room there for that. And there's the other extreme, which is like if you're living in a cult.
Yeah.
If you're living in a cult, you know everything you believe. There's no gray areas, and they all fit together. And so, you know, what our nature is that when new information comes in, we compare it to everything we already know. And if it doesn't fit, we tend to think that's probably not true. Or we, you know,
right, the confirmation bias, right? Yeah,
right. And if you're in a cult, you can't get information that falsifies your cultish view because it gets screened out. So I think we're more in that we're moving towards a situation in which we're all living in a kind of cult.
Yeah, we're in our super niches and
very definite ideas about everything, they all sort of go with all the other ones, we think. So how to break that?
When you said before about being in community or being where you're having to be face-to-face with folks that may be different from you in different circumstances, so they're still seeming to have agree on the values. I feel like I'm about to ask you a question, but I feel like both you and I inherently know the answer. Having to constantly come up against adversity and be the different one, that actually teaches you, frankly, a significant amount of humility, gratitude, survival. Can't be in a state where you believe you're the... or you have to have a state of your own, you know, sense of being, but you're regularly confronted and observing these different ways of being that you don't have the merciful gift of just being in a bubble. It really doesn't exist.
Right.
You can't even create it. Even the bubble you try to create is really, you know, your reality is poked fun at every day.
And, you know, that's a blessing and a curse.
Right.
and there's a sense in which I feel lucky to have grown up or to be in a situation that kind of inherently makes me realize that there are different ways of viewing the world, and from each perspective, the other one looks like something strange. But there, you know, it's like that relativistic view. I like that I'm capable of having that. That doesn't mean, or for me, it doesn't mean that there's not some final truth. There is, but we're humans. We can't get there. We can move that way, but we can't be there. We're not.
Right, we can grasp it. We can try to grasp it, and language is going to be imperfect to capture that entirely. You've seen the stages of people of society, or more of a global conversation towards maybe agreeing somewhat what the problem may be. But you've also written really beautifully about how there may be an argument about what the problem and the power dynamics of this planet should be, and we're in the middle of that at the same time. I loved one of the quotes that you had from Alina, from your daughter. She told you what the stages of life were going to be. And she's like, anyway, after you've chosen what to feel like, you go into being a senior citizen. You probably retire. You have time to do what you want. And if you're lucky, you're still with someone. If not married, so you do what you want with your husband or wife or whatever you got, and you get old and then you die. Oh, I see. Is that pretty much it? Pretty much. But all these stages go on for a very long time, Daddy. But if that's the case, does it feel like, what a waste? Why even bother? No, because you have fun in all these stages, Daddy. So we've been in the blessing and curse of certain crossroads of history and seen some of the pain of it, and then been observers to watch and be able to translate that, and then the own personal things we've dealt with. And what you're describing is a cycle of, in all of these stages. Can you speak to those stages of almost, I don't want to say what's it like to be in your 50s when you're in America, when you're in your 20s when you're an American, but no, the stages of these things, which you're able to think about certainly on a personal life level, but also you're able to think about the history of the world level. And when you think about these stages of life, what would be the wisdom that you could offer? Unless we want to stick just with your daughter's advice, which probably is accurate. It's true. There is so much fun in the stages. There's great sorrow and tragedy and hilarity as well.
They're not all fun.
They're not all fun. Yeah.
And I will also say I'm 70 now. Hmm. And I will say that when you're 70, it isn't as obvious that all these stages go on for a very long time.
they
go by pretty fast. A long time back in the Portland days, I had this kind of revelation for me, which was that there really were three stages of life. Hmm. And I saw them as, the student, the learner, the doer, and the beer. And that, up until a certain point, if you learn something, that day is fulfilled. You know, that's, you've done your thing. That's good. Anything else you do is just icing on the cake. But then you go into another stage where you're still learning stuff, and it's good to learn stuff. But if that's all you've done, you haven't done what you're supposed to, because you're holding up the sky, you're keeping the people fed, you got a job to do, this, you got to be there. So that's a whole different stage. But then, you know, in a tribal sort of world, you get to a place where you're done. You sort of don't have the what you need to really.
Yeah, the sticks and stones of the body aren't quite.
You know, what you do have is something that usually goes by the word wisdom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can give other people the perspective that you have because you've lived a long time. And that's your job. Your job is just to be there and for people to absorb some of the spillover of having lived a long time.
Yeah.
So I do feel like I'm in that stage now. You know, I was like, I thought I was going to enter that stage when I was 50. You know, at that point, yeah. I thought, okay, it's over. What am I doing now? And it turned out I've had a whole life between then and now. You know, it's like a different life than I ever lived, because that's when that's when 9/11 happened. I wrote an email. Yeah. Then I became involved in every possible sort of thing that has to do with Afghans and all the chaos in the world, terrorism and so on. But I have come to a place now where I'm like, well, you know, what I could do, I've done, and it wasn't much, but whatever it was, that's all I could do.
Oh, it was rather significant, and folks can't see. I'm deeply feeling for personal reasons that I can relate to on the stages that you're talking about, accepting those stages and what that may mean in the wisdom of that. And then, of course, very much for the work that you've done. Many folks might not be aware, so we're talking very much about road trips and becoming American, that end of it. But most of the past 2 decades for you have been significant time of service where you've been talking with the military associations, you've been talking with, everything from libraries to community leaders to public officials. I mean, it's just across the planet and dug deep into what's gone on in the Afghanistan where you're from, as well as the policy issues and the history alone in Destiny Disrupted, which is a pretty tight book considering what you get into. I would feel very proud myself to have left such a legacy, to know that you've done that. I think that's enormously proud in the space that you had doing. But you're right, if you're 70 now, that you're saying that happened when you were 50. So for those of you who are a little younger and think you're going to hit retirement or some sort of easy going, let me just break it for you right now. It's not going to happen. The other thing about becoming American is we don't have a social security net. So just prepare, you know, not a real, you know, social net. So unless you're coming from somebody that paid off your loans and other kinds of things, yeah. You have property and you have all these things combined, and even then,
yeah.
Let me let you know, you're going to be working for a while. but there's also something in that stage of that's a complete pivot that you didn't expect in the last 20 years.
It is, and you know, the thing that drew me into it, and you know what I felt like I had a role to play and something I could say, was so entirely bound up with, now that I look back at it, was so entirely bound up with, we shouldn't go to war. And yeah. I feel that more strongly than ever now. And I feel like many things that happen in the world and that political people do and so on, many things are not exactly a choice. You know, there are circumstances like this and they're driven to do it. That was one of those rare instances when we could have gone two different ways and we went the war way, and nothing has worked out since then. You know, so now at this remove, you know, you have the sharp sense of poignant pain about the situation with refugees at the southern border here. And that's also happening everywhere else.
Yeah, everywhere else it's happening. It's certainly been a significant thing for a lifetime. What's difficult is I can't separate my life from like understanding the refugee or foreign policy thing. And this isn't it's political consequence. It ends up being political, but I didn't choose it. I happened to grow up in a time where everyone I grew up around were, mm-hmm. so my friends as a kid were Afghan refugees, were from Iran. Right. Yeah. And you're laughing at it because you understand that the policy effects were from El Salvador, you know, and so these were the realities. And so that meant that everyone I grew up with pretty largely when I was a small child, much less, of course, the military exposure you get, were people who were coming from one place or another, mm-hmm. All of us becoming American, but also that was the world that we were in. And so it's it's an old story to me, similar to actually, you know, even the terrorism story that we have with those issues. It's an old story to me. The question of what our country doesn't get involved in that kind of bravado. I don't think you don't even have to have a political perspective to not be like that was some bravado in 2003. And it's poignant to me right now to realize that what the actions on the border right now are pressing at me are to answer a question. I'm not trying to make it grandiose, but certainly at some point with abolitionism in the States, and slavery, we had some of the same conversations. I'm just noticing, especially as a historian, social scientist, you just notice the language repeating itself. I think we do have a global international crisis and many different issues certainly across the planet, but to speak to my own country and the background I've had here, we're having some of the same conversations that we had about movements of people that were very particular to that time. And it's disturbing, presses a larger question. And we're then up against climate change, and we're then up against the warfare itis.
Yeah.
There are consequences and responsibilities. And so it offends me that my country would be engaged in doing the things that we've been engaged in and not expect that to be part of the deal. And I can only make a slight commentary on how I feel about former colonial powers and the other part of the planet. But that is also that's part of the marriage, the agreement, that's part of the conversation we've been in for a while. So to have refugees or immigrants treated a certain way, not just personally painful in a way that's just, stabs right at the heart, but it's really clearly offensive as an American for those things that you were talking about before, what we've been about, and then more importantly, our policymaking. And so it's hard when it becomes that abundantly clear that no, this can't be the way. And what that transition means, and why you would need to write several books in several ways and have those conversations across the country to get to the bottom of what that may be. This might be a fair moment to actually talk about Afghanistan. You last went a handful of years ago, in 2013.
Yeah, when I published Games Without Rules, I was there just before that. So 2012, I was there. You know, I don't think I'm going back, not because it's dangerous or whatever, but because it's far away and I don't want to travel that far.
Right. This is similar to myself with Honduras, where I was there in 2012 around the same time. And certainly it has the same, there's a different version of that violence going on, but it's pretty violent and it was pretty difficult to get around. And as a woman, of course, you can imagine it's pretty difficult to get around. And I want people to hear that. I want to hear people to hear that I'm talking about a place in Central America. We're talking about a place on a complete other side of the world. And then when you're talking about that interconnection, there are larger conversations that we need to have.
There are larger conversations. You know, when you speak of refugees, one of the things that I only really just learned the numbers the other day, there's 3 million refugees in Turkey, and many of them are Afghans. And of those Afghan refugees, many are women, you know, that have fled from great horrors. And one of the things that I think is difficult to put into account here is that they're the kind of the first and most vulnerable victims of war itself. You know, when the war comes in and destroys all family structures and stuff, and makes a society in which the only thing that counts is how much power you got and how willing you are to shoot your gun. Women are completely trapped in that society, you know, in that circumstance. There's nothing they can do. And so then they try to run away, but it's hard for anybody to get from there all the way to Turkey. And when you get to Turkey, where are you then? You're nobody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just want to mention an amazing movie I saw the other night.
Yeah, please.
There's an Afghan family. They had something called the Art Cafe in Kabul. They had poetry readings and stuff just like you. And, you know, the conservatives started to threaten them. They tried to find refuge in Tajikistan. They couldn't. And they were kicked out. And they knew that they were going to be killed if they stayed in Afghanistan. So that whole family, there's two little girls, there's the wife, the husband, they decided they were going to try to get to Europe. And they're both filmmakers, the husband and the wife. And they decided, we're going to make a documentary about this. And all they had were cell phones. So they shot a movie on their three cell phones.
Wow, yeah.
And now they're still in Turkey, in Germany. They got that far, but it took them 3 years to get there. And they can't get out because they still have not gotten political asylum ratification. So they're in a camp, but they made this movie. It got to the Berlin Film Festival, and from there someone brought it here, so I saw it. It's called Midnight Traveler. Yeah. If it comes around, do not miss it.
That's phenomenal to make such a film, make it under such circumstances, but also recognize the reality. I feel like, this is a smart-ass thing to say, but, you know, I am who I am. But that if you took any of those sort of policy wonks or you know, representatives, I'm trying to say that kindly, or folks, you know, working to approve these things, you took any of them and you flipped them in the opposite direction of that journey, and then you have them answer the question whether or not there should be asylum granted, we'd have a very different response. I also want to say, you know, we talk about refugees and things across the planet. The other thing to recognize is it's not as if in the States this is a, you know, we're immune, that we don't have, we're both coming, you know, from the Bay Area originally. We're talking about a significant amount of people displaced with housing and economic realities. So this isn't to say that there's not many people on the planet facing that. And the question about, I think if we talk about becoming American, is what that would be. You talked about being not ashamed to be who you are in any room. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be the, if people wanted to talk about an ultimate assimilation, that would be it, to not be ashamed to be who you are. And on the other end, to not shame people.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one.
I'm amongst good inspiration today.
One of my Afghan American friends, you know, he's the son of Afghan family that fled during the communist era. So he said something one time that really stuck with me. He said, when I go out to school and stuff, you know, his upbringing was, when I go out into the world, I pretend to be an American. And then I go home and I pretend to be an Afghan.
And
I ask myself, when am I not pretending? When this question came up at a place at a community college where I was giving a speech, and people said, well, I feel like I don't fit in this way, and I feel like I don't fit in that way. My feeling was, my response was, all the ways that you don't fit in, that's who you are.
Yeah.
Add them up and be okay with it. That's fine.
Yeah, and for those writers that are hungry to get out there, you've got volumes of work on that to show of being who you are, that actually can lead your way into finding your story, telling your story, and becoming more of who you are. So you mentioned Midnight Traveler, which sounds like a phenomenal documentary to be on the lookout for, so we'll include links for that. Anything that you all have been loving, anything, any person, any bit that's been inspiring or encouraging or just joyful and just having fun with?
Well,
I mean, Raul was fantastic, obviously.
Raul is one of those things.
Yes, Raul the cat, so you all can't see, but he's...
Raul the cat is one of my my small good things, you know, as Raymond would say.
Yeah.
And another thing I really, just really like is my little tiny garden out there.
Mm.
I've got like 20 feet by 20 feet or something like that, 25 feet by 25 feet, that's my yard. And I go out there and I plant and I dig up weeds and stuff. You know, I really like that there's nothing digital about it.
Amen.
Every single thing there is a real material thing. But also what's really cool is that, you know, plants have so much, there's so much their own whatever they are. You know, they're on their own time scale. And they know how, what they need in terms of nourishment. They're busy finding it, and they have relationships with one another in the garden. And it's just, it makes you feel like, if this is part of reality and I'm part of reality, can't be that bad. On our road trip, one of the places we went to was Joshua Tree. That's a desert, and it only blooms like once a year for about a week.
Yeah.
And we happened to be there in that week. And it's so phenomenal that in a environment that everything about that environment says, you can't live here. This is not fit for life. And yet life has found a million ways to live there. There's like such a variety of plants, so many strategies. I think that's really great.
Yeah, you continue to be humbled by how everything else is able to just be.
And it's working out. And it's working out. Yeah. And then you're like, what the heck have I been?
Well, when I'm out there, I can somewhat get to I just be.
Well, the last question I was going to ask you is, in that, I think we talked about a lot of good things for the being stage and kind of the learning stage. But in that doing stage, for folks that may be in the middle of that doing stage, whatever that may mean for them, do you have any good thoughts if you were to think back on that, or what you wish you'd understood more so with doing? Some people can obviously burn out, this one in. Some people can obviously get paralyzed by there's so much to do. But whatever that doing means for them, what would be your recommendation for folks that might be in that stage or contemplating approaching that stage? Or needing to, frankly, get off their butts. And
well, for writers, I have a piece of advice. The way to get to what you're going to write is just start writing. That's the whole thing right there.
Yeah.
And then you can worry about what you've written. But the first thing you got to do is just sit down and start typing up words.
Yeah, and still it's there. Until it's there, you really don't have anything to to worry about. It's angst. It's just like we're angsting about, the wind blowing. It's not even blowing. It's just dead air. You need to get some things down. I often say, just the writing. Like, people ask for advice on anything, it's pretty much the same stock answer: write, read.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then my daughter Jessamine has a piece of a thing she wants just kind of tossed off, and I always think about that. In terms of like the process of writing, you just write until you just have to outline, and then you just outline until you just have to write.
Yeah, and then right where we go. Yeah.
but bigger than that, I don't know. It's like we're all walking through a jungle, and you just have to look for the path and keep going.
Because I realize that we're talking baby boomer age, and we talk about some of the road trip content and those things, and so baby boomers are rather significant block on the planet right now as a huge population. Do you have anything that you'd want to give them as a takeaway as they think about their next stage that you might be thinking about with your next stage here?
Well, baby boomers.
Because we hear too much of the millennials. This is my way of saying, like, oh, we're not going to nag on the millennials anymore. Like, we need to.
The millennials are a new wave, just like the baby boomers, I think.
Amen. Yeah.
There are all these little labeled generations between Gen X and blah, blah, and blah, blah. But really, this is the first time that there's been a new wave like that. And even though I feel like I can so experience now as I never could before the millennials, that I guess it's not my day anymore. Oh. I do feel that. But I also feel like I recognize something of what they're feeling that says anything is possible, it's all different, we should break it all down and start over. I don't want them to, but I'm not cool with the word disruption, but I think we used to say revolution in the same way.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, yeah, the brand name just changes, but we keep on.
Right.
Right,
but when I see some of the technological things that are happening and that millennials are like in the midst of it, I go, yeah, I can see why they could imagine that they could build a perfect new world, a world in which everything is available and nothing costs money. They can imagine that. I think it's that easy, but
they're at a starting place that's different. That's fortunate for them to not know the bumps of what other people have learned the other way, but also they're able to start with a different slate than some of us. And there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But yes, there's some wisdom to be gained by looking to the past.
Well, but for the baby boomers, I would say nothing ever ends. Everything we ennobled and pursued and sought, it didn't just stop. It just changed, and some of it went underground. That's growing up as new plants elsewhere.
Yeah.
There's life has continuity.
Yeah, it does, and we need each other.
We
need each other, certainly in a large sense. We need each other, including across the age groups. But we need each other, regardless of our porcupine situation, regardless of the good reasons on the porcupine situation, or we think to carry weapons or whatever, that we still need each other.
Yeah.
So I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much for taking this time out on a lovely afternoon in San Francisco and here on the island. It was very good to get to talk with you. I feel very grateful. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Take care.
Thanks for joining How Did We Get Here, where we flip ideas on how we move through this life and talk about what's really going on here.